Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast, and today we're talking about AI hype, but not in the way you might think. See, throughout its long history, AI has been overhyped. As early as the 1960s, laypeople and even some experts were already predicting that we were 15 to 20 years away from developing human-level AGI. And while excessive hype about AI capabilities or the imminence of AGI have been recurring themes, the AI community has also suffered through what many consider to be phases of stagnation, or AI winters, where very little progress was being made, often to the embarrassment of researchers who themselves bought into the hype that preceded these slowdowns. And so today, it sometimes seems like AI researchers are a lot more cautious, maybe even too cautious, when it comes to describing the capabilities of current AI systems. Rather than overhyping, there's now a trend towards underclaiming the state of AI capabilities and the rate of progress in the field. Now, that trend can take many forms, from highlighting often contrived edge case failures of otherwise powerful AI systems to dismiss them, to implying that the failure modes of language models in 2019 still apply to the models we're building today. Now, my guest today is Sam Bowman, who recently wrote a paper titled "When Combating Hype, Proceed with Caution," where he explores this phenomenon and coins the term underclaiming to describe it. Sam joined me to talk about his paper and how underclaiming might actually prevent us from making good decisions about how to steer the AI ship on this episode of the Towards Data Science podcast. Really excited to have this conversation. It's a topic that I think is somewhat counter to the usual narrative in AI. There's a lot of talk about hyping and overhyping AI, things like that. And you've been very thoughtful in terms of your analysis of what's going on in the space, whether we actually are overhyping. Maybe, I don't know if this is the right term, but maybe we're underhyping or certainly underclaiming, as your argument suggests. So I want to start just with a little bit of an overview of the argument, the case that you make in this paper that you wrote called "When Combating Hype, Proceed with Caution." Can you lay out an overview of your perspective on what's maybe going a little bit wrong with the way we're talking about AI these days?
Yeah, so I guess I can do it in three or four parts. So the claim isn't that hype isn't that there isn't hype in AI. There's a lot of hype, both from media and from tech companies and from researchers. Hype is sort of definitely a real problem. But what I'm seeing and what this paper is about is this phenomenon where researchers who are less directly responsible for product development, less directly contributing to hype, are becoming very, 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 very aware of hype and very, very conscious of not wanting to contribute to sort of overly strong claims, not wanting to contribute to the sort of culture of sort of techno-solutionism or something like this. And I think this is often reasonable. We as researchers very often sort of wind up in the situation where we sort of see a really exciting strong claim come out of the media or see a really exciting strong claim come out of a paper, and then sort of look into it ourselves and discover it doesn't really hold up. So we're very used to being disappointed. We're very nervous about reinforcing hype. And so this leads towards this sort of pessimistic attitude. This leads researchers to take this attitude that kind of any claim you see in the literature is probably a little bit overstated. Any sort of cool, exciting, positive result you see is probably not really that good. Our technology is probably not really that good. And to some extent, this is sort of a reasonable sort of starting attitude given where we are. But I think increasingly often I've been seeing it, at least in NLP and language technology where I work, turn into something that's a little bit scientifically sloppy, turn into people making negative claims, making these sort of counter-hype claims, these claims that something doesn't work, when the evidence suggests otherwise, or at least when there isn't good evidence. So that's kind of, yeah, go for it.
Oh, sorry. So what are some examples of that? I'd love to see, like, especially in your domain of NLP, like, how does this materialize in AI?
Yeah, so let me run through three that hopefully give a rough sense. And these are all focusing mainly on what happens in the academic literature, though I think there are echoes of this in at least sort of the public conversation among researchers. So one of them that I think has been really clear is how we talk about older negative results. And in my paper, I focus on how we talk about a specific paper, this Robin Jha, Percy Lung 2017 paper, that was one of the first papers that sort of showed in very concrete terms how brittle and how unpredictable some of some sort of neural network models for language can be. They were showing this way in which you could very, very simply find test cases that would trick a question answering system that just looked obvious to a human. It's sort of very clear to a human what the answer to a question was, but if you tweak the past question, if you tweak the past in a certain way, even though to humans it looked totally irrelevant, our machine learning models would mess up half the time. This surprising result, this very influential result, showing that our systems are not that predictable, are not that robust. So I have no complaints about this paper. My complaint or my concern is that this came out at the beginning of 2017. It was talking about sort of modern neural networks in NLP as of late 2016, early 2017. And our technology has just actually gotten a lot better since then. If you look at the phenomenon they're studying, it's mostly gone away, not entirely, but in very large part. And we sort of more or less know why. We've figured out all these things about pre-training and how to sort of take advantage of large data sets, how to make our neural networks bigger so that they're learning more sophisticated representations. We sort of made real progress in the problem. But the pattern I'm seeing is that this paper gets cited for the really general claim that modern neural networks are broken. Model neural networks are brittle. Modern neural networks don't understand language. And so you'll see these citations, these references in modern work that just point to this evidence. And so you wind up making this claim that sort of might sort of feel true-ish. There might be something to it. But if the only evidence you're pointing to is evidence about a system from 4 or 5 years ago, you're sort of, this is no longer really a falsifiable claim in the relevant sense. You're no longer really connected to the current state of the field. And so you're potentially just gonna be saying something misleading or false. So there's this whole pattern of citing old negative results as though they apply to current tech. That's one example, yeah.
I'm just curious about that particular one, because I'd imagine, you know, there's a temptation to always be, at least when I was writing papers in physics, you know, you'd always be perusing the latest literature. You want to make sure that everything's accounted for so that when you publish something, it's not out of date the moment it, you know, it's not dead on arrival, so to speak. Why do you think that's maybe not the case here? Or maybe more specifically, why do you think people are citing this paper in this way? Like, what's behind that impulse?
I think the basic impulse is sort of reasonable. I think people have this skeptical attitude toward modern systems. They feel like it's grounded in some real evidence. It's grounded in some real experience. And they're just looking for sort of something to point to kind of back up this claim they're making that sort of current systems are brittle.
It's like confirmation bias in a way.
Yeah, sure. It's sort of people are looking for something to point to back up this claim that they think is kind of obvious to everyone involved. And don't look that hard to really make sort of the strongest, most rigorous version they can. And I think sort of there's this asymmetry in sort of research culture, this asymmetry in how peer review works that kind of lets everyone get away with this. And that's widely understood that if you're claiming sort of your new thing is so great, your idea is so great, the evidence you give there is getting a lot of scrutiny. But if you're claiming that sort of some nebulous current technology that you're not pointing to very precisely is not very good, these kinds of negative outward-facing claims aren't taken quite as seriously as scientific claims, and so don't get the same level of scrutiny, even though if you're repeating claims like this in every single paper, that you really are sort of changing our collective understanding of where we are as a field.
So the expectation of being disappointed predisposes us to accept by default claims about systems being disappointing. Like if we're less, okay. Now I interrupted you in the middle. I think you had a couple of different examples. So I want to let you kind of flesh those out as well.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll run through a couple more. These are all things that I see in the literature that are not necessarily someone doing something kind of completely obviously wrong, but just wait, doing things that contribute to this sort of pessimistic attitude in ways that aren't really grounded in the evidence. So another one I've been following is the field's reaction to this paper that won a Best Paper Award a year or two ago by Bender and Kohler that makes this point that I think is a reasonable point and worth taking seriously, that pure language models like GPT-2, GPT-3 don't understand language in the way we usually use the term understand in science. This term means a lot of different things. Even linguists use it to use it in a lot of different ways. But I think conventional idea is that meaning or understanding is the relationship between language and something that's grounded in something outside of language. So if you understand the sentence, sort of, the chair is blue, that has something to do with your visual or physical experience of the chair. You're connecting language to something in the outside world. And if a language model is only using language, it doesn't have anything else to connect that to. And so we wouldn't conventionally say that it is understanding. And this was a good point. I think this is pointing out ways in which people were being sort of sloppy or overly optimistic about these technologies. But the main point in this paper, the main point that they really defend, isn't grounded at all in any empirical facts about language modeling. It's just grounded in this fact that they're only taught to deal with language. And so it doesn't make any particularly strong predictions about what they can do. So for example, on this framing, it's totally possible that we could discover one day that sort of GPT-5 or GPT-6 is really a perfect translator. It can translate any text from any language to any other language as well as any human. I'm not sure if this will happen, but I think it's conceptually possible. It could be that our models are learning a really rich internal representation of the world that's not grounded to the outside world through anything but language, but that sort of, it could be that they're learning enough about the world that they're able to do translation perfectly well. And what we'd say there is not that they're not doing translation, but just that it turns out that translation doesn't require understanding in this strong form. So they're making this claim that if you read it sort of casually, oh, language models don't understand language, I think implies this very negative stance toward what language models are able to do. But I think there's actually not that much there. I think they're leaning on a very precise technical definition in a way that doesn't tell you that much. And again, sort of the my concern here is with how this work is cited and how this work is referred to. You'll see a lot of people in NLP say, language models are exciting and all, but they don't understand anything. So we need another paradigm. This isn't going to work. This isn't going to get us what we want. And I think this can lead people to sort of artificially lower their expectations of what practical problems, what real problems language models will solve, and what abilities they might take on.
It does seem like the word understanding is a load-bearing word in this context, and that a lot of people don't see it as a niche, nuanced, highly specific, even technical term. And when I hear the word understanding, I do tend to think of something almost, something basic, something without which these systems would not be useful. If we're going to claim that language models can't understand things because they don't map their language onto the real world in some way, I'm wondering, like, if we had a human being who was blind, who was even mute, and just could take in language, like just like GPT-3, would we not be tempted to say that this human still understood things at some fundamental level? It just kind of seems, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm butchering the definitions. It seems like maybe there's a double standard thing going on here, but I don't know if you have thoughts on that aspect.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings there. I will call out, there was this massive Twitter argument over the last couple of weeks about roughly this analogy. I think it doesn't quite work. I think sort of even someone with sort of very different perceptual experience is still going to have sort of some sensory connection to the outside world that isn't language, pretty much without exception. There's also a separate argument of kind of when it's a good idea or bad idea to compare these models to humans, especially humans with disability. But I think it's not a perfect analogy. I think our systems are really just getting this exactly one channel of communication in a way that is importantly different. But to riff on sort of this issue from another angle, I think there's this idea that the way that I'm framing this sort of this issue of understanding from the Bender paper is all about whether a model's internal representations of the world map onto something external. And if you've got a pure language model, if you've got GPT-3, that isn't happening. I mean, it's easy to show it's not happening just because there's no connection, there's no other modality for it to map onto. But there are two ways in which I think that claim might be less important than it looks. One of them, maybe the more straightforward one, is that it's pretty easy to bolt that on. If that's something you care about, there are efforts from a lot of places, including OpenAI, who are behind GPT-3, to build multimodal language models that are also experiencing also experiencing audio or video or images or sort of involved in robot control or something like this. There's a very straightforward path to sort of take these models and make them more grounded, if that's something we think is important for what we care about as language tech researchers. The other way in which I think this claim might not actually matter so much is that these models, at least conceptually, seem to be able to learn a lot about the outside world through language. So these models aren't learning what it looks like for something to be read, but they're learning what kinds of things are red. They're learning how red relates to other colors. They're sort of learning this rich model of like what redness is. That's not quite grounded into the outside world, but it's still grounded into a lot of the knowledge it's picking up from text. And this kind of sort of ungrounded or purely text-based model of the world empirically seems like it's able to do a lot. It seems like we're able to use these ungrounded models to do some pretty exciting things. I don't think it's obvious where the limits of this are. It's possible that pushing that idea further will really let you do most of what we'd want to do with a system that understands us.
Yeah, this really starts to make me think of a lot of the sort of French philosophers, French linguists who talked about, like Jacques Derrida. He kind of had this idea of language being this graph in high dimensional space, where if you're going to define a word, you can only ever define a word with reference to other words. And so you have essentially a graph that's suspended in nothing and therefore ungrounded, or at least that's like one view. Obviously, evolution shapes that graph, and in practice, a lot of that implies multimodal inputs that have nudged things in certain directions. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like the graph itself, once shaped by evolution, like the text that we trained GPT-3 on was shaped by evolution. It was shaped by multimodal inputs as interpreted by humans and then codified in text. So I guess I wonder if there is even really a meaningful distinction between what's multimodal and what's not, if multimodality has been implicitly embedded and coded in the text that the system is trained on.
Yeah, I think that is this really important question for the field is sort of how is, we've got kind of two routes we could go. We could really emphasize multimodality, emphasize integrating all these other kind of interaction into system that just turn out to be very expensive, very hard to do well. It turns out just working with text is efficient to store, text is efficient to feed into models. Working with text gets you really far really fast. But if we really care about multimodality, we can do it. We have a bit of a roadmap there. It's a sort of question of like where this trade-off lies of how far you can get, how well you can do with this very unhuman-like way of learning purely through text, but this way of learning that really, really leans on this immense, immense amount of sort of human output, human cultural output in the form of all the text that we can find anywhere we can find it.
Yeah, it sort of seems to get to this question too of like, are we going to end up approaching something like AGI by building things that mimic human reasoning, or are we going to approach it through a completely different vector? And if it's the latter, it kind of seems like we should be very open-minded about what the milestones are that tell us that we're getting closer. Because, you know, we talked about this previously, actually, in a previous conversation, but there's a sense in which I think we have this understanding of intelligence is something that's approached through one of two different channels. Either like we're used to seeing children who are initially kind of stupid by a certain definition get less stupid as they age and grow, and so we're used to seeing general intelligence approached in that direction. And then we're also used to seeing general intelligence approached from an evolutionary standpoint, where we see the continuum from like ants to mice to cats to humans and something like that. And both of these, like, mice make a very different set of errors than a two-year-old might, and vice versa. And so I guess if we take that thesis that, hey, we might actually build something that looks nothing like a human, that doesn't need multimodality, it kind of becomes difficult to say, well, yeah, we're on the right track versus we're not, if the milestones are...
I agree. I think there is a sense in which if you're really strict about, we're only paying attention to language models, we're only paying attention to sort of GPT-X, we're not going to get completely something like AGI, no matter how optimistic we are, just because these humans have all these other ways of interacting with the world that we're not going to get. But it's possible that we're going to get very close, and it's possible that we're going to get very close in ways that are really important. It's possible that all right, maybe we're not going to get AGI, but we're going to get something that can do basically everything that an expert lawyer can do, and it turns out you can do pretty well without certain modes of interaction. Like, it could be that we're still able to reproduce or expand upon really advanced sort of understanding and reasoning communication abilities in ways that turn out to matter.
You had a third point to raise here, and I cut you off again. So sorry about that.
Yeah, so I won't belabor this too much. But the last one I wanted to highlight just live here is this trend towards adversarial evaluation in NLP and I think other areas of ML, which is the idea of sort of when we're building our benchmarks and we're building our metrics to test sort of how good a model is at some skill. Because models have been getting pretty good, we've been focusing on building benchmarks, building test sets that are explicitly focused on cases that models fail on. And this kind of makes sense. If you wanna have some like very precise metric that you can hill climb on, you want the number to start off low, so you can make it bigger. And this is the way to do that. But there's a version of this that I think is pretty broken and that has been showing up in literature, where this is called something like adversarial data collection for test sets. Or what you do is you take a state-of-the-art model, you take a few dozen people, probably hired over Mechanical Turk, and you teach them to try to trick the model. They get to play with maybe a sentiment model in real time. They try typing in example movie reviews, and they only get to click submit and get paid if the model guesses the sentiment of the review wrong. You have people do this for a week or two. You collect a bunch of reviews. You're again only keeping the ones where the system disagreed with humans. And then you're using that as your benchmark, using that as your test set for models' ability to evaluate sentiment. And what this gets you, totally predictably, is if you test the state-of-the-art model, the model you were starting with, on this data, it will get all the examples wrong because you selected for the examples it's going to get wrong. And if you test a model that's similar to that, it's going to make similar predictions and it's going to get almost all of them wrong. And this doesn't The fact that these models get this wrong isn't an interesting fact. If you do this against a human, you mm-hmm. can find corner cases where the human gets it wrong, or at least where the human disagrees with the person who wrote the example. And so you end up in a situation where you have a test set where models get very, very low accuracies, but this isn't actually telling us anything interesting about whether the models are any good. And often the papers that actually produce these data sets are reasonably careful about what claims they make. This process can be useful in certain cases. But then again, this work will get cited and referred to in ways that say something like, hey, if you look at a real test set for sentiment analysis, a real carefully built test set for sentiment analysis, you'll learn that BERT or dBERT or GPT-3 fails completely, fails totally, isn't solving the problem at all, pointing to these 0% or 10% accuracy numbers in ways that are just completely circular, that you're defining what a valid example is by saying a valid example is one that your system gets wrong. And then you say the system gets all the valid example wrong. It's completely circular. You haven't actually learned anything. But if you refer to it sloppily, you'll wind up with these statements that look like they're saying that current systems are weak in an important way.
These are really great examples. I remember the Truthful QA benchmark that was published about GPT-3, same idea, right? Picking out cases that were adversarially chosen to fool GPT-3, and lo and behold, you see this. And the Truthful QA paper, like you said, I mean, they are quite responsible in the paper. They make it really clear what the process is and what this benchmark is for. And to your point, it's important. We need to have benchmarks like this so we can find what the weaknesses are. But it's I guess the risk is in the citation, and it makes me wonder.
Yeah,
like I could almost imagine, you know, a cultural practice in AI that could be beneficial. At the top of a new paper with a new benchmark saying like, hey, like, do not cite this paper to support the following claims or something like that. It's really clear. But it's fascinating. I'm curious as well your take on what the effect of this is on the field. Like, these are really interesting cases and they do seem to point to something. So what do you think they're pointing at in terms of implications?
Yeah, so the paper gives kind of three ways in which this phenomenon of underclaiming seems to be having an impact. Or really the impact that I'm claiming is just that people are taking this sort of a very pessimistic stance where they assume that systems don't work. And I talk about three reasons this matters, three reasons this can have implications in the outside world. And I'll go through those. One of them is very close to home, very much sort of about us researchers. One of them is a bit more sort of broad and open-ended and about the outside world. And the other one's a little bit more speculative out there relative to sort of the normal conversation in the field. So the first one is just that if we're making all these claims that our current systems don't work, we're setting ourselves up to waste time. We're setting ourselves up to put a lot of research effort into solving problems that we don't actually have. if it turns out that, all right, like our systems actually work pretty well, and we've got this recipe that if we scale them up in certain ways, they'll work even better. That suggests a very different research trajectory than if we say, oh, language models are completely broken and understand nothing, so we're gonna waste our time. The, I mean, obviously there are lots of research directions that are language models that are worth our time, but we wanna be doing those for the right reasons and know why we're doing them. The second motivation, and this is, I think, where things get a little bit tricky and get into this interesting sort of cultural split in the field, is that if you care about the sort of immediate impacts of NLP, of AI technology in the world, I think this practice might look like it's helpful, but I think winds up backfiring. So there's this, I think there's this attitude I've heard people express directly, which is that if we put a positive spin on how good our systems are, whether or not we mean to, we're going to encourage the systems to be deployed. We're going to encourage people to build products using our systems. Mm. And there's this really, there are a number of reasons that can be problematic. I think a really salient one is that lots of major technologies in NLP, including language models, are biased. They bake in a lot of attitudes about race and gender that are really problematic that we can't ethically or legally build into our products. And we don't have a good fix. So there are a lot of technologies that are really interesting, that seem to be doing really sophisticated stuff with language, but also are really ethically dicey to actually use. And so this attitude that we shouldn't discourage, we shouldn't encourage their deployment. And maybe we should try to discourage their deployment by downplaying how good our systems are. Mm. But I think that's just not a sort of super stable, workable practice. I think what we're relying on is kind of this idea that we have this audience of product managers who are deciding what to build, what to deploy, who are listening to us and taking us completely seriously and never looking at the evidence. Because I think what I worry about is this case where someone is debating whether to build a product for doing resume screening or doing content filtering or doing something that's kind of sensitive. They listen to sort of us researchers and we say, no, this won't work. Language models, they're bad at language. They don't understand you. But then they try it out anyway. They see some of the hype from somewhere else. They try it out anyway. And they say, hey, it makes my metric numbers look good. If I do a little pilot that looks like it's making me money, I'm going to go for it. And what they've learned then is they can't really trust researchers' assessments of the state of the art. And so then if we researchers come back the next day and say, oh, no, also these systems are extremely biased. And also, like, you're going to be really reinforcing these inequalities in a pretty serious way if you deploy this, they'll stop listening to us. They'll stop taking us seriously as people who are sort of engaged with the same kinds of questions that they are, and we'll lose our chance to steer that conversation.
So there's a crying wolf aspect to this to some degree.
Yeah. So I think there's this instinct that we can do something that in the extreme starts to look like crying wolf. And I think that gets really delicate. I mean, obviously when we have real evidence the systems really won't work and really won't make you money, we should use that for this reason. But I think we have to be very careful to, again, stick close to the evidence.
It's challenging too, because there's such a push, at least I remember this in, again, this is physics and my work in machine learning has been industry work and not academic work. So I'm not sure how closely the physics tacks on to, but I remember, you know, there's like this intense pressure to publish or perish. And to the extent that you have a finding, including a negative, like if a negative finding allows you to make claims that earn citations just the same as a positive finding, especially if it's easier to identify negative claims. Because if you don't have to build the new system yourself and say, hey, look at what all this can do, it might be a little easier at the margins to find an existing system and like find all the ways that it breaks, get the same number of citations from that. Again, this is might reflect a misunderstanding of the dynamics here, but...
Yeah, no, I think there's something there. And in the paper, I don't speculate too much on exactly why this is happening, exactly why this seems to be becoming more common. But no, I think there's something there that building new systems in NLP has gotten, in a lot of areas, has gotten hard. We've wound up in a situation where we've got a lot of our eggs in one basket, where it really seems like the thing that works is to build these enormous, expensive, hard to manage systems. And so if you're kind of a normal PhD student at a small university, not plugged into one of these big networks that's building this stuff, it's very hard to write the conventional positive paper where you go make something work. And it is genuinely useful and genuinely interesting to study what these existing systems do and point out their limitations. And so I think a larger fraction of research looks like that, looks like this work that's making these negative claims. And I think on its own, that's not a problem. I think if a lot of people are pointing out issues with these systems, if they're really grounded in the evidence, if they're really honest about what the issues are and what they're not, that seems great. But I think that's just you've got a lot more people who haven't who are in a position that it's sort of natural and comfortable to make these kinds of emphasize these kinds of negative claims. I think you're right. You're right about that.
I think you're right to tie it to this consolidation that we've seen, the homogenization around foundation models, where it seems like, you know, DeepMind, OpenAI, Microsoft, NVIDIA, and so on, like they're able to spend $10 million to train a model. And, you know, you have academics to some degree looking on and unable to contribute to benchmark breaking in the same way that they used to. It used to be purely academics who are breaking these benchmarks, which almost leaves you with nothing else to do other than to look at these models and criticize them, which, to your point, I mean, I guess it's in almost calling out that shift of responsibilities. If this turns out to be a permanent trend, it's going to be important to kind of openly acknowledge that trend has occurred, so that academic research isn't viewed, yeah, through that same lens of saying, okay, this is an overview of the state of the field. Rather, it's sort of filling in some of the holes that are left by big players that can spend $10 million on an AI.
Yeah, I think that's completely right. And the sort of the term foundation models goes back to this workshop at Stanford that's kind of been pushing this view of the field that I generally agree with. And one thing that was really, really clear consensus in that workshop is that this is not a great situation to be in. Like, we don't want academia to be playing this role. And so one of the things they were really emphasizing is be more like physics, is like, don't write $500,000 grants for two PhD students, write $50 million grants that are shared across many universities for a huge team to do something big, to sort of that in order to keep up with the field, that academics are going to have to team up and do bigger, longer, more expensive projects.
Like CERN or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. CERN, oh. CERN, I'm sure, came up 5 or 6 times in that job.
I'm not surprised to hear it, actually. And actually, one consequence, I suppose, of this sort of centralization, too, is you do just have fewer papers being published about systems that are powerful and making positive contributions to capabilities. So there's just like, you know, there aren't many OpenAIs, there aren't many Microsofts, and so on. And so you end up with this like distorted sense that all of the big announcements are about negative things, whereas there are a couple of really big announcements about positives. But
yeah, and I think this is another social aspect of this is getting more extreme, which is that some of the groups that because a lot of language modeling work, sort of a lot of the hard work is in sort of systems building, software engineering. A lot of these teams that are doing this work that's really important to NLP, these things like these big language models, don't actually have that many NLP researchers on them. So if you go to a big NLP conference, there might be 3,000 people there, and there's maybe one person from OpenAI who worked on GPT-3, and two people from that team at Microsoft, and a bunch of people at Google who are maybe connected to something, but it's like the overwhelming majority of people you'll meet at a language technology conference are not working on these projects.
Well, that's fascinating.
Even at conferences that theoretically include industry participants.
Okay, yeah, so that is a shift, I guess, as machine learning becomes more and more software engineering, and it becomes about compute, it becomes about how do you wire these things up, and less about like we're outsourcing more of our cognition, I guess, to the machine itself. So there's less tinkering to be done by NLP.
Yeah, no, I think there are a lot more good ideas to be had on that are specific to language about how we do this, how we use it. But I think it's just sort of a lot of these big companies, like the immediate low hanging fruit looks more like engineering, and so you'll wind up with these teams that are skewed more that way.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so I interrupted you again. This is becoming a trend.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Yeah, please. Totally. This is great.
I think you have a third
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So the third, so it's kind of going through like reasons we should care. The first one is this is maybe not great for the field. This will waste our time. The second one is this will make it more difficult for us to really engage in the public conversation about current impacts of AI. The third one, which doesn't come up as much in this literature, in this conversation, is that it'll make it harder for us to think about longer term impacts of what we're building. Mm. So the idea here is kind of the way that I generally see it, and the way that I think sort of there's a piece of the community that sees this is a lot of these sort of scaling law of results matter. It seems like we've found a recipe, or we found at least a research direction where we can kind of keep turning the crank. We can kind of keep doing what we're doing. And even if we don't make any big new discoveries, our systems will get much, much, much more capable, that we'll see big progress in understanding and communication and reasoning. And that it's really, really hard to forecast what that means, but it's sort of easy to forecast that that's going to be a really big deal. Mm-hmm. That if you extrapolate this out 10 or 20 years, you're looking at systems that are very, very powerful, that can automate a lot of pretty advanced, sophisticated professional work. And that you start looking at things like, all right, what does this mean for mass unemployment? What does this mean for misinformation campaigns? What does this mean for surveillance? What does this mean for consolidation of power into few players? And sort of like you end up getting a lot of these sort of very serious long-term concerns looking real and looking concrete and looking like we have a timeline on them. And a lot of these are things where it looks like it really matters that we start thinking about these now and start preparing for these now. And I think that if the consensus of the field is that this isn't happening, that we aren't getting better, it's going to be a lot harder to rally technical researchers to engage in these conversations about figuring out what's happening and what to do about it and how to make it go well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that resonates deeply with me, at least based on the work that I do day to day. But I think one other category beyond just technical researchers too is, you know, policymakers and people in governments. Very, very hard to get. We've run into this quite a few times where this phenomenon of underclaiming or the idea that, oh, actually, you know, maybe we're headed for another AI winter, and that's a possibility that some people are hedging against, responsibly so, but there is a possibility that we're not, and it's very difficult in a context where there's, let's say, more emphasis on what systems can't do that sort of starts to warp people's perceptions of what's possible today and what may be possible in 5 years. Very hard to get politicians, very hard to get policymakers to actually act on this stuff if they have a story, you know, that tells them why this won't happen, especially if that story it leans too far in the direction of saying we don't have a recipe.
Yeah, I think you wind up right now, if you're thinking about this, if you're kind of looking in from the outside of should I care about longer term impact from AI, you wind up looking at you wind up seeing sort of there's two options. You could look at two literatures or two communities. If you pay attention to kind of the mainstream sort of university-centered ML, AI, especially NLP research communities, you'll see this attitude of, we're not making much progress. You've got some stuff that's interesting to play with, but like, stay tuned, nothing interesting is happening right now.
Yeah.
And if you look at these places that are explicitly focused on long-term impacts of AI, this sort of like OpenAI has a big division doing this, DeepMind has a big division doing this. You look at things like Global Priorities Research Institutes, places that are very explicitly like, we don't care about what's happening now, what's happening in 10 or 20 years. They're very often basically saying, this is the most important problem in the world. We're gonna destroy civilization. This is like an absolute catastrophe. And that's a very weird position to try to be in. It's odd that there's kind of no conversation between these two views, that no one's trying to figure out, all right, what is the, how do we make this more concrete? How do we ground these forecasts of catastrophe out to actual concrete research questions we can answer? Which of the premises in these arguments stands up? I think it's right now you just kind of have to pick. Are you sympathetic? Do you like to believe that we're heading for the apocalypse, or do you like to believe that nothing is happening and technology won't change? And I'd like that not to be the obvious two options you're immediately presented with that you have to decide before the evidence, without really getting a chance to read any serious conversations about which of these two views is closer to right.
Yeah, and it seems on the surface of it that there's sometimes even an outright conflict between those two views, where you have some people saying, well, look, these systems are affecting people in the here and now, we shouldn't deploy them for this reason and that, and then there can be reasonable arguments to be had there. But then, you know, when you look at what you've just described, I think is fascinating. I don't think many people realize this. When you look at DeepMind, OpenAI, Anthropic, when you look at the ecosystem around AI risk, generally speaking, what you end up seeing is people are literally planning for a future 10 years from now where AGI will exist. Like, the conversation, and it's like said in such a casual way, as if it's just this and then you switch gears and you talk to people who are maybe focused on current days or like academic stuff, and you hear completely different views on timelines and or certainly completely different focus of attention on more day-to-day things. It also seems to have implications for what you choose to work on. Like, if you're even an AI safety researcher, you're doing work on aligning, for example, AI systems with human values. Do you choose to work on today's architectures? Do you choose to say, well, I think that the thing that gets us to AGI is prosaic AI, is deep neural networks with maybe reinforcement learning and a couple other things that we already know all bundled together. If you think that's it, then you can start working on much more concrete, explicit solutions. Whereas if you're committed to a view that says, well, these systems have all these problems, they're not really gonna work in the future, so we're gonna need a complete paradigm shift, you might find yourself hedging and maybe doing much more foundational kind of research with fewer priors, fewer assumptions.
Yeah, that seems right. And yeah, I think that this is very relevant to these conversations about how you do AI risk research. And there's also, yeah, this tension that sort of if you, I think there's this weird filtering that if you come into AI research, you're sort of have some technical background, you want to contribute to the field, and you're just like, how can I do work that's useful in the world? How can I do work that is sort of not strictly profit optimizing, like that I think is just going to be fixing real hard to fix problems? Then just kind of depending on where you start, depending on who you start talking to, you either wind up very much focused on this kind of foundational theory of how to stop AI from destroying the world, or you often wind up in this literature, which is very much focused on present day harms, very much focused on sort of stopping unfair deployments of systems. And there's no conversation between these two, or these two groups, like, it's gotten weirdly adversarial. There's this view that they're competing for resources, and it's the sort of zero sum game that I pay attention to both things. I try to contribute a little bit to both communities, but I feel like that's hard. And right now there's not a lot of conversation about sort of how do we get a holistic view of sort of what the impacts of our research are and what we should be paying attention to.
Okay. And actually this starts to get us into, you know, what ought we do about this? So I know your paper does have some recommendations about things people can do to combat specifically this underclaiming issue. Would you mind kind of laying some of those out? What are some of the ways we can start to improve things?
Yeah. So the main theme of that part of the paper is just, it shouldn't be that hard. I think the people who are doing this kind of underclaiming, the people who are sort of who are kind of writing the papers that I'm calling out, they mostly have PhDs or they're most of the way through a PhD. And I think like the thing you really reliably learn from a PhD is that if you say something, if you make a positive claim that's too strong in your paper, you'll get yelled at. Your advisor will yell at you. Your reviewers will check your paper. You'll get an angry audience question at the conference. You get this very clear feedback if you overclaim. I think overclaiming and underclaiming are really sort of the same thing. It's making important statements in your paper without adequate evidence. And so I think that like if you're aware that these claims matter, if you're thinking of these claims as something where there's something at stake and where people are paying attention to what you have to say, then you can just turn all these cognitive tools and sort of research tools you already have onto this issue, and you'll be fine. I think if there are enough researchers who think this is a real issue, who think underclaiming matters, then most research teams or most peer review panels will have a few people who are thinking this way and who will spot the issues and say, hey, don't do that. And then people will walk back their claims and say, all right, maybe I'll cite John Young as important influential paper, this negative result paper, but I'll say explicitly like, okay, this was a negative result as of about 2016 models. We've made progress since then. The current situation is more complicated. I think kind of most of these users, if you point out the real flaw, they'll know what to do. They'll know how to revise their claims into something that's more grounded. So that's the main thing. I think just if we get people to pay attention and we get enough to pay attention, the problem is mostly solved. I think there are a few things that help. I wrote some sort of very civic guidelines for writing of like, here are just exact types of claims to be careful about making. I think there are a few types of research to try about, especially getting better evaluation for systems that'll try to maybe kind of slow down this ping pong between overhyping and underhyping. And then the last thing, I think maybe the most specific or most unusual recommendation I make is just that I'd like to see us pay a lot more attention to this sort of scaling laws line of research. This line of research of trying to look for clear patterns in how our systems improve as they get better and in what ways they improve. Because it does seem like there's something there. It does seem like sort of some of the early attempts at this work. And if you've got really clear trends about how your systems are improving, that makes it easier to direct your skepticism. If you observe a result that's been obviously forecast for several years, that's probably more or less right. If you observe a result that's just wildly off the trend, people are making claims that we've achieved something that there's no reason to believe we could have achieved, that's when you be extra careful. And also just, I think scaling laws is helpful for thinking about long-term impacts anyway, of figuring out how concerned we should be about what when. But yeah, that's the rough landscape of recommendations I was making there.
So I wonder about one aspect of this, which speaks to implications and what we do to correct for this, I think. And that's the idea of what is actually being implied when somebody says, well, this 2017 system proves, let's say, or suggests that today we still have this problem in an LP. When somebody says that, it strikes me that the implication is, it's not just about saying, hey, there's a problem with current systems. There's kind of a broader, maybe I'm reading into it too much, but it feels like there's potentially a broader suggestion that we can expect the field to move more slowly, that we ought to be pessimistic about AI capabilities, that the kind of person who would say something like that ought to also expect certain NLP-related benchmarks to be smashed later than somebody who doesn't reference a paper like that. And to the extent that that's true, I'd find it interesting to have people actually make predictions. If they're going to write a paper about the limitations of language models, something that gets us closer to a world where academics are making predictions and then being held accountable for those predictions in some form. I don't mean financially or career-wise, just like that it's clear that there's some kind of track record that you've drawn these inferences about the future state of the field, not just criticizing existing systems, but if you're trying to kind of imply something more than just the sentence that you're saying, then maybe it'd be helpful to make that claim explicit. Gopher, for example, the Gopher paper that DeepMind put out a couple months ago now, they explicitly compared what I think it was what prediction markets were saying the capabilities of systems would be by the time Gopher came out to the actual capability of the system, and they saw that it completely smashed expectations. I mean, it was like, 2 years ahead of its time or something like that. I just wonder how many results like that could actually start to reshape this narrative in a more constructive way. I don't know if that aligns with your
view. Yeah, I think this. I haven't been thinking too much about how prediction markets fit into this, but I like this. I like this attitude. I think you're pointing at something very real, which is that even these slight changes of framing or wording can really matter. If you say you're citing this John Long paper to say deep learning based reading comprehension systems are very brittle, that really strongly implies this prediction that until we have a big paradigm shift, until we do something that isn't deep learning based reading comprehension, we should expect progress to be very sort of tricky and halting because we're working with bad building blocks. If you say sort of this dynamic memory network or this DBERTA XL, like this very specific system is brittle and is failing, that leaves the question much more open. It's like, all right, there's something about the system, either the data it was trained on or at scale or something about the architecture that wasn't quite right. But like, if we make progress on any of those, the question's open again if the problem's real. I think I haven't tried getting researchers to make hard predictions. I'd like to see how that goes, but I think that is cutting it, that is sort of getting at this real difference in how framing in these papers can what framing in these papers can lead researchers to believe.
Well, really fascinating discussion, Sam. Thanks so much for sharing all this. I think it is important. A lot of people who listen to these podcasts are, I believe, writing academic papers. In fact, I know that to be the case. So hopefully this is something that can prompt a little bit of thought there too. And more broadly in the field, I think it's important that people be aware of, yes, the scaling laws and where all this leads in 5-10 years. So thanks so much for sharing all this sort of constellation of thinking that you've been doing.
All right. Thanks so much, Jeremy. This has been fun.